Well, hello there, everyone. This is Dr. Leslie Kernison of Better Health While Aging, and this is going to be another coronavirus, also known as COVID-19, special for the website and the podcast, in which I am going to share an update and some suggestions. And today is June 11th, 2020. So as you all know, this, you know, we continue to be living through a really unprecedented pandemic situation in the United States and really worldwide. So things keep changing quickly. But in this episode, what I want to cover is the situation today, now that we've been going through this for about 3 months in the United States, really. And so I want to recap what I think are the most important things we've learned about coronavirus so far. I want to share some updates on the testing situation and current recommendations for reducing coronavirus transmission. I know that lots of people have questions about, is it safe to do this, do that, visit grandchildren, visit family members, go to the beach, go back to work. So I'm going to talk about that for a bit. And then, of course, I'm going to focus on my particular area of interest, which is how coronavirus, you know, affects older adults in particular. And I want to especially talk about the trade-offs that we're now seeing we're going to have to face for the next several months, likely at least a year. And then I'm going to finish with my recommendations for this summer. So, quick recap of the situation today. I know most of you all know this. We're all following the news, but you know, basically, as of today, we're at over 2 million cases in the United States and over 110,000 deaths. So it was a difficult, challenging spring, especially in certain parts of the country, especially the state of New York, New York City, and New Jersey experienced a really scary spike in cases, and their hospitals were nearly overrun for a while. Now, things have improved since then. And even though things are better, and a lot of states are, you know, starting to reopen, it's important to realize that we are still having about 20,000 new cases diagnosed every day. And the kind of national reports indicate that there are still about 700 to 1,000 deaths, depending on whose count you consider and on the day of the week. There are still 700 to 1,000 deaths every day. Now that's down from when things were really bad in April. They were at about 2,000 deaths. So, you know, things have definitely improved, but that's still not a trivial number. So now most states went into some form of shutdown and restriction on social activities and business activities in April and May, and a lot of them are starting to reopen. In part because people are hankering to get back to work, to get back to activities. And at this time, as of the reports of the New York Times, which tracks COVID cases in all the states, 21 states are currently on an upward trend, including my own home state of California. It's also important to know that, you know, experts widely agree that we still don't know exactly how many cases we've truly had. It has become much easier to get tested, and, you know, the goal is to be able to test more widely. And especially in the early times, it was hard for people to get tested. So we don't truly know how many people had coronavirus. Also, in terms of counting deaths from coronavirus, most experts think the official figures are an undercount. Different states count the deaths differently. Certainly, if you look at how many people died in a given state this spring compared to the year before, it's much higher. So I would say that, first of all, the current numbers are probably still an underestimate. And also, from another perspective, it means that we still don't exactly know what is the mortality rate for coronavirus, for whatever that's worth. I don't know if we would do things very differently if we knew it was a tiny bit higher or lower than we have. But there it is. So So if you haven't been following along the cases and deaths, I don't think we need to be looking at this every day, every hour, because it does weigh on one. But if you're looking around wondering like, what is the situation? It's important to see the trend over time. And so what we can see, again, the graph up top is new cases reported by day. Again, whether a case is reported and diagnosed depends on a lot of things. That's why you have to take the number a little bit with a grain of salt, but it's the true number is probably going, it's almost certainly higher. So you can see we were at 30,000 cases a day for a while in April, and now we're down closer to 20. And then the deaths, again, we're at about 2,000 a day, and now more like around 100. So things are better, but we're not out of the woods. And that is sad and frustrating to hear because so many of us are so tired of living under these circumstances, and we long to get back to the way life was before. And I think it's important to acknowledge the toll that this takes on us psychologically, and that many of us, are going through experiences of grieving and mourning. The life that we used to have, and not being sure when will we be able to, go to dinner parties and, feel comfortable to travel, to see families. So we're longing for this to be over. But I'm sorry to say it's better, but it's not over. Despite the, beaches opening and things reopening. So, and we'll talk more about staying safe about that in a moment. So what have we learned about COVID illness and treatment? So we have learned a lot, and I could not hope to summarize it in a short presentation right now. So I just want to sort of highlight a few particular things that when I step back, I think we have learned as a medical professional. So you've almost certainly already heard it, but one of the things that is, kind of remarkable and interesting, but also makes COVID very challenging is this very, spectrum of how seriously ill people are. So we don't know the exact percentages, but clearly many people, most people, have mild to moderate illness. That is like some, flu-like thing, often with coughing, respiratory things, sometimes more with gastrointestinal symptoms, and often with some fever. And they recover at home within a week or two. But as we know, a certain proportion of people get more seriously ill the older you are, or if you have chronic conditions, the more likely you are to get seriously ill. But we've also had people who are relatively young, even people in their 20s and 30s with no pre-existing health conditions, get quite significantly ill. So being younger is not a guarantee of safety. And then among the sort of more significant illnesses, we've realized that beyond the pneumonia that many people get, there are coronavirus can attack the body in many other ways. So we've realized that in some people it creates clotting disorders, and some people get a what's called an encephalopathy, a brain dysfunction that's not just being older and having delirium, but is really the brain malfunctioning because the coronavirus is affecting. Seems to be affecting brain function. Some people get, weird skin symptoms. Some people lose their sense of smell and taste, although I think that's, I think of that more as a symptom than an attack on the body. So a lot of variety there. And health providers are still actively learning. One, how to recognize those, and two, is there something in particular that we should do to treat people when they're showing one of those particular manifestations? We also know it affects, the heart, for instance. So lots of right now, kind of thoughtful experimenting as they try to treat people. Still, a lot of people with serious illness do end up with low oxygen levels. And we've also realized that people will have these low oxygen levels and not actually feel short of breath or symptomatic as soon as we often expect them to. So that's led to a lot of interest in people having what's called the pulse oximeter device, that little clip on the finger that shows you your blood oxygen level. And so there's interest in helping people access that, especially if they're being treated at home, because we're still trying to figure out how to recognize the people for whom it is safe for them to stay home and continue to recover, and the ones who are kind of trending in the wrong direction and really need more monitoring and more care. And then, we're still trying to learn, like, what does that different care look like that's going to make a difference in people who are getting seriously ill? So if people really can't get the oxygen they need into their blood, then we think about a ventilator, a machine to breathe for them. And earlier on in March, people had such low blood oxygen levels and seemed so sick from their pneumonia that the doctors would tend to put them on ventilators fairly quickly. And now they've really, they're really working on trying to delay that because they found that if you give people more oxygen or if you change their position, it's often possible to provide them with some support in breathing and kind of tide them over, and maybe they can turn the corner and not need the ventilator treatment. That said, some, a certain number of seriously ill people do need the ventilator. And then there's still a lot of, discussion about what is really the mortality rate on ventilators. It definitely depends on sort of which group you're looking at and what were the criteria for those people to come into the hospital and get on a ventilator, whether those people were on average older or younger. So it's not easy to answer that question. So I feel like there's still not a clear answer to me about, what is the likelihood of recovering if you're on a ventilator. And it's definitely going to depend on, are you somebody who was relatively healthy before and is under 50? Are you someone who's in like the 50 to 70 age range? These are all approximations. Are you much older, say 85 plus, and did you already have health problems? But, a large number of people on the ventilators do die. Some of them do recover and get off of the ventilator. But what we're seeing is that often being on the ventilator is not something that people experience for just a few days. They may be fairly often on the ventilator for at least a week. It's sounding like 2 or even 3 is not uncommon. And so what we're starting to learn now about is, the recovery process for those people who were on ventilators. So in general, if you're very sick and you lie in bed for days or weeks, every day you lie in bed very sick, you're losing muscle strength and you're losing abilities. So the longer you're lying there in bed, the more you've lost, and usually the longer it takes to build that back up. And then, of course, how quickly you can build it back up partly depends on, the resilience of your body. People who are younger and healthier are generally more resilient. And people who are older, had health problems, were frailer, are much less resilient and can really take a long time to recover. So, that's a whole other area of learning right now is what is the best way to support people who have gone past a time of hospitalization and illness for coronavirus. And then we still don't know whether there are going to be long-term health consequences for those people. So we're learning a lot, but overall, unfortunately, the treatment still at this point is mostly what we describe in medicine as supportive, quote unquote, which means that you basically try to support the body and organs while the body fights the infection and tries to clear it and works on healing itself. So they, drug trials are underway. There's no clear slam dunk treatment yet. There's one antiviral called remdesivir that in trials has been shown to have a, quote, modest effect. I think it was studied mostly in people who were in the hospital. So, with antivirals in general, they often work better if you give them to people earlier. So I'm sure they're going to do trials on that. But of course, when you have this many people getting coronavirus, how to give a medication like this early to lots and lots of people would also be a challenge. So lots of things remain to be studied and sorted out. And then just, for older adults in particular, we know that older adults often manifest illness a little bit differently. So we're also still learning about, as people get older, what are particular aspects of coronavirus that we need to be aware of? Are there ways we should modify the treatment so that it's more likely to be successful in people who are older or frailer or have certain health conditions? All of those things are still being learned. And now, what about testing? So, testing's a really important issue, both in order to, first of all, find out if someone has it ideally earlier, especially if we think that there is something we would do differently to help improve their odds of getting past it. So what do we know about coronavirus testing? So the good news is that initially we were plagued by a serious shortage of tests, and it was very hard to get tests. And now in most parts of the United States, that's much, much better. And we also now are talking about two main types of tests. So you've probably already heard about this. So first we have diagnostic tests. These are the tests we've been, trying to make available to people from the beginning. These are tests that are meant to see if a person has a current or active infection with coronavirus. So it looks for molecular bits of the virus or for antigens, pieces, proteins from the virus in people's, usually people's blood. So there's that test, and that's, really to see, do you have coronavirus now? But there's another type of test that is also being very actively developed and studied, and that is an antibody test. So antibodies are proteins that your white blood cells create after you've been exposed to a virus or another type of illness sometimes, and your body creates them to fight the virus. So antibody tests can be detected usually a few weeks after somebody has been sick with an illness, so they indicate past infection. Now, they can sometimes also indicate immunity. I mean, this is the whole principle of vaccines. Vaccines are meant to expose you to an inactivated virus or a piece of virus to get your body creating the antibodies, because once you've created them once, you're usually much faster to create them in the future. But how long you retain that ability is kind of variable. So there was a lot of interest early on, could we tell who had it? And then, would we treat those people differently? I know in Europe at one point they were floating the possibility of immunity passports. I don't know that anyone's seriously considering that now because, there were a lot of the devil's in the details, as they say. But sometimes we do want to, certainly it's important from a perspective of how many people in the country or in a community have had coronavirus and trying to guess sort of how many susceptible people there are and how quickly it's likely to spread. Antibody testing can be really helpful for that. And, again, it's a work in progress. So those tests are also called serology tests. So we have those two types of tests. And I think the thing that's important to know is that, first of all, there are a lot of tests out there. There are 100 plus tests, and they have not gone through a formal FDA approval process because all of this has come along so quickly. So instead, these tests have gotten emergency authorizations by the FDA. Now, there are other tests out there that people may try to pitch to you or encourage you to buy that don't even have the emergency approval of the FDA. I think it's probably illegal to be, selling them, touting them, and implying that they are a valid test. But, there are always people out there trying to make money. So right now, all the tests that are emergency approved by the FDA require a health provider's order. So you should not be able to buy a test on your own with no health provider's prescription or order. And if you see one for sale under those circumstances, then I would be really concerned about its legitimacy. But even among these tests that are emergency approved by the FDA, what we're finding out is that a lot of them are showing false negatives. And so this is another area of really active, research and development, is trying to understand which types of tests are better. So we really want a test to, first of all, be positive if someone has the illness, but also be negative if they don't have the illness. And a false negative is when somebody actually has the illness, but the test reads negative. And that's dangerous because those people might, first of all, continue to go out and get close to other people and actually be spreading coronavirus, or perhaps we may not monitor them as carefully and notice if they're getting sick. So the ballpark estimate that I came across doing a few days of research this week is that up to 30% of negative test results may be false negatives. Some tests are going to be better than others, but often if you're the person asking for the test, are you in a position to look up the test right now and see on the FDA website how it performed in are you able to get data? And I think most of the time we're not. Also, there's something when it comes to tests that what we really want to know in epidemiology and from a clinical perspective is how, if the test is positive, how likely is it to be a true positive? And if it's negative, how likely is it to be a true negative? And that number, we call that the positive predictive value and the negative predictive value. That is partly a question of the innate test characteristics, and it's a question of, in the population at large, how many of them are generally positive or negative. So you need to know that that also. So for those who want to learn more about this, I'll share a link. The CDC page on serologic testing goes into a little bit of an explanation of this. And so they show how, as the prevalence of positive coronavirus goes up in general in a community, the more likely it is that a positive test is a true positive. So this is all to say that testing sounds great, in theory, and is really important. And for it to work well the way we need it to, we ideally would have tests that have very few false negatives and false positives, and we're not quite there yet. And we ideally also need to know about how much coronavirus there is in a community to properly interpret the test result. So we've made a ton of progress in the last 3 months, but we're still not yet where we need to be to effectively use testing to monitor and control COVID spread. So I'm optimistic that this is going to continue to get better this summer because there, a lot of people are feeling very motivated to improve this, but it's still a work in progress. So then, what do we sort of know? What do we know about coronavirus spreading? I put sort of because, again, this virus keeps surprising. And the medical community, the public health community, and revealing, new subtleties and new angles. But right now the general thought is that it's, in terms of spread, it's very similar to the common cold. So that the main way that it is transmitted is that it's in what we call the respiratory secretions of people who are infected, and so it gets exhaled by them. It's present in little, small, and microscopic droplets that people exhale. First of all, when they breathe, they don't exhale usually a ton of them when they breathe out through their mouth, but they do. But when they talk, that creates more. If you talk loudly, even more. If you sing, we're finding out even more. If you cough, lots there. And then also when people sneeze, then they're also expelling them from their nose. So that's the main way. Now it also looks like coronavirus is shed in stool, poop, and it might also be in other bodily secretions, such as it's being studied to what extent it's in breast milk or semen. Or even blood, but it's really thought that the main way that most people are going to get exposed to it is through what was exhaled by somebody who had it. So that means that to catch it, you need to breathe in enough virus, or you need to basically inoculate yourself by touching a surface that has virus on it, and then touching your face, especially your eyes and nose. That's how cold viruses usually get into people, and also potentially the mouth. So also, if somebody talks, coughs, or sneezes, like right in your eye or your nose, that might inoculate you. And it's really thought that although touching things that have coronavirus on them, and you can potentially then infect yourself, it's thought that that's definitely possible, and probably some people are catching it that way. But the consensus is that, in most cases, it's really what's called person to person, that it's from being in a nearby space to somebody else and their exhalations and kind of breathing it in. They think that's what, most of it is probably causing. And so being in proximity to people who have it is the way that people catch it. And so generally you're just going to have the level of proximity you need. First of all, people in your household, right? We're touching a lot of the same surfaces, and we're often, face to face talking to each other. And then potentially, in workplaces where you're close to other people, which is true for some workplaces. They also think that the more virus particles you take in at the time of exposure, that affects your likelihood to fall ill, and also your likelihood of developing severe illness. So again, if the mailman has coronavirus and maybe had a little bit of it on his hands or gloves, and handed you the mail, and you put your hand on a coronavirus particle on the letter and brought it into your house, it's still overall a small amount of virus, and it's not quite the same as if you were to there, talk face to face with the mailman for 10 minutes. That would be more. And if you talk to them for half an hour, or if you were at a dinner party with them, that would be even more. So nobody can say exactly how much virus is too much, but in general, when you're exposed to more of it, that puts you at higher risk. So we're thinking a lot, again, about what are ways that everybody can spend, less time in spaces where they're likely to get exposed to a large enough concentration of what people are exhaling. Lastly, it's unclear how long the particles are infectious on surfaces. They definitely have been shown in, one study to be infectious on hard surfaces for, I think it was up to 2 or 3 days, on cardboard for 24 hours, less time on copper. But the presence of virus doesn't necessarily mean it's still quite infectious. So generally, we know that it lasts longer on hard, non-porous surfaces than on soft surfaces. And also, the virus does deteriorate outside because of UV light, wind, dehydration. So, the expert consensus is that being outside is almost certainly safer, and that you probably don't need to worry a ton, again, about touching your mail or briefly touching surfaces. That said, we still want to be, washing our hands often. So that leads me to, review like the current thinking on what we think reduces COVID spread, whether that's, in communities or among individuals. And really, what reduces it between individuals is what ends up reducing it in communities, right? So the recommendations right now to prevent or reduce transmission, first of all, masks, especially to prevent infecting others. So what we know is that a fair number of people have minimal or no symptoms, and it's also quite clear that people are shedding virus and are infectious during a day or two before they develop really obvious symptoms. So now some people might be feeling a little sick, and they still might be out and about. Either they don't think they have coronavirus, or some people really need to work to bring for the money, and they don't have paid sick leave. And even though they don't want to, expose anyone else, they're kind of crossing their fingers. So you just kind of don't know what's going on with other people. So there is a consensus that if everybody since we can't often know if we might have it and be spreading it, if everyone were to wear a mask, they wouldn't be exhaling out their droplets in the same way, because a lot of them get caught by a mask, a surgical type mask, or even a homemade version. So, you know, those are the cloth masks or even bandanas that people are now wearing and that have become required in some areas. So I live in San Francisco, where it's now required to enter an indoor space or a business to wear a mask. So masks keep us from inadvertently spreading our germs to others. If you are at high risk, or you know, especially want to reduce your risk of inhaling coronavirus particles, then there's the possibility of wearing a tighter fitting mask to protect yourself and prevent breathing in coronavirus particles. So, you know, the classic example that now everyone has heard of is the N95 mask. The downside of wearing those is that, you know, they're a lot less comfortable than a surgical mask is. You know, surgical masks were designed for surgeons to wear in the operating room so they didn't spew their germs into the body cavity that they were operating on. And those are, you know, often worn for, I mean, surgeries routinely last hours and hours. I think I remember in medical school that for certain types of surgeries, we would easily go 8 hours just standing there. So N95s are much tighter and less comfortable, and they're, you know, designed to prevent contagious illnesses prior to COVID. I remember as a medical student and resident, we would wear them if we had somebody with suspected tuberculosis in the hospital, and they would be in a special room to keep the air from, you know, going out of their room. So those are an option. And the thought is right now that we don't all need to be wearing those, but certainly if you're somebody who is at higher risk, you have pre-existing health conditions, you're older, or frailer, or you really want to make it, you know, a very high priority, to minimize your risk, you could wear one of those. Other things to reduce transmission, hand washing, washing hands often, especially when you're outside your home, it's probably a good idea inside your home too. Avoiding touching your face when you're in public or when you're exposed to surfaces that are touched by people outside your home. Avoiding time close to other people who are not in your immediate household, especially indoors. So, you know, this is not a good time to be riding in a car for an hour with somebody who is not in in your household. And I would say this is not a great time to be on planes, even though I know some people need to get somewhere. And also I feel for the airline industry as well. Also, as you know, communities, there's an effort to disinfect high touch surfaces in public spaces. So, you know, stores are certainly doing that, you know, facilities. And then ideally, we would also have a way to promptly identify and isolate positive cases. So, you know, this is about having testing available. This is about people who are having symptoms or realize that they were exposed being willing and able to get tested. That they can also, you know, then if they test positive, be isolated and kind of quarantined so that they don't spread it to other people. And ideally, we'd also be able to trace and test their contacts, right? So when we have a positive case, we would interview them, find out like where had they gone, who had they been in touch with, and contact those people. So this is a strategy that certain countries have used quite successfully. It was a mainstay of the coronavirus control strategy for South Korea, actually. They did less shutting down because they were really, really good at testing people, identifying them, isolating them, contacting everyone they were in touch with. So ideally, you know, we would be doing that because, again, we're trying to reduce the number of people who are out inadvertently spreading coronavirus to other people. And then another aspect that is often recommended is to frequently and routinely test people who are high risk, because they're often, you know, because their work or life situation is such that they're quite likely to be exposed, and or they are likely to pass it on to people who are at high risk of catching it or getting very sick from it. And so one example of that population would be people who work in nursing homes, right? They are at higher risk of exposure because of the nature of the environment and the job, and also because they're having to leave their house and go out to work. Some of them sometimes work in other facilities as well. And they work with an older, often older, frailer, vulnerable population where the stakes are higher if those people get it. So that's what, I would say is the consensus right now in terms of what would reduce coronavirus spread. So is it safe too? So given that, people are still, coming to me, and I think coming to all kinds of health providers asking, is this safe? So the thing to remember is right now, nothing is going to be 100% safe. So in terms of so what I think is important to focus on is, developing a way to kind of thoughtfully think through the risk of coronavirus for of exposure to coronavirus or catching coronavirus when you're considering a certain activity. You want to have a way to think about that to be able to think, are there any sort of steps that you could take or ask people to take to make the activity a little bit less risky? And then you want to make, a thoughtful, informed decision about whether engaging in that activity, justifies the risk. So how risky is an activity going to be? That's going to depend on a couple things. One is it's going to depend on how prevalent COVID is in your local community. So one of the things that I would recommend to everyone is to sort of get familiar with what are some information sources that you can rely on and check on. You don't have to check every day. We don't have to just have this be the big thing in our psyche all the time. But I think having a sense on a, maybe weekly or every other week basis of how much coronavirus there is in your local community and whether it's been going up or down is useful, because again, the more of it there seems to be going around in your local community, the more likely it is that the people that you're about to come into contact with might, that somebody might be harboring it and exhaling it into your immediate area. And then, the risk also depends on, again, how close, when you engage in this activity, are you going to be getting to other people's exhalations and respiratory droplets? And for how long, right? Is this a short encounter or is this a longer encounter? And how much airflow is there around you? So, in general, we're really recommending social activities outside. Lots of airflow, and the virus tends to deteriorate, with like wind and UV light. Whereas when you're in an indoor space, there's a lot less airflow. At this activity, are people going to be wearing masks? So, I think eating indoors in a restaurant sounds risky to me. People can't keep a mask on while they're eating. They're often talking to people. You're in an indoor space. And, quite famously in Asia, there was, somebody who was at a restaurant, and the, people at the neighboring tables got sick, and it was very much related to how the air conditioning was circulating the air. And also, for a meal, people aren't usually in and out of there in 10 minutes. They stay for, an hour. So lastly, how much are you touching the same surfaces, right? So if you're going to have a picnic with friends in the park, it's much better if you don't touch the same plates or foodstuffs, right? Especially since, again, while we're eating, we tend to then, that's a situation that's more likely to bring our hands towards our faces because we're putting things in our mouths. So those are some of the things to, to consider, and then again ask, could some adjustments or modifications be made to the activity to again reduce your proximity to other people's exhalations, create more airflow, get more people wearing masks, not be touching the same things. And then the last consideration is for the people who you're going to be near, how much exposure have they had to coronavirus over the past 1 to 2 weeks? And this is something that reflects, sometimes people's personal choices, but also a lot of things that people may have less, find less easy to control, such as their work circumstances, their transit circumstances, and their family circumstances, right? So some people are able to do their work from home right now, are in a very small household, where they don't, get exposed very often to other people. They go to, stores that are close by and wash their hands a lot. They're being very attentive. Those people are low risk. But some people work, jobs where they have to go out and be in proximity to other people. In some metro areas, people still have to take public transit to get to work. Some people, live in small households where everyone's able to be very careful, and some people live in larger households, and maybe there's somebody in the house who, works at the hospital and is going into the hospital every day. So again, if you're considering an activity, sort of thinking about those people that you're planning to get closer to, what are they doing to minimize their coronavirus risk? Whether those are personal choices that they might be making. Like to not go to activities that bring them close to people, or whether that's their work circumstances. And then lastly, your risk is going to depend on your personal susceptibility, which I don't think it's going to be hard for any of us to personally know. There is research suggesting that people are more susceptible as they get older, all things, equal. And then I'm sure there's, this will be another interesting line of research. There are probably genetic susceptibilities to both catching it and getting it quite sick. The latest interesting research nugget to come out, or one of the recent ones, is about blood type and coronavirus risk. So now it seems that type A seems to be more susceptible. That's bad news for me. I'm type A. And type O is potentially less susceptible. So, but that, that determines the risk. So as you think about, is it safe? I would probably think a little less about your personal susceptibility, other than the older you get, the more susceptible I think you should assume you are to catching it. And then if you have chronic conditions, you should consider yourself at more risk for getting quite, for getting significantly ill from it. But otherwise, it's really about, how much coronavirus is going on in your local community, how much exposure have the particular people you're going to be interacting with had, and then, what are the circumstances of the event or encounter, and can you make it any safer? So really quickly, a word about coronavirus and children. So this is important. So when it comes to older adults, there's been a lot of desire to see grandchildren. This has been one of the heartbreaking things about this pandemic, is that it has, most families have opted to keep older adults safer, have opted to keep grandchildren away from grandparents, and that's been difficult for a lot of people. So in general, we know that kids are much less likely to develop COVID symptoms. And severe illness is relatively uncommon. Not unheard of. We have had pediatric deaths, but the children have a much lower chance of getting significantly ill. It's still debated just to what extent they are less likely to actually catch coronavirus, and to what extent they can transmit it. So it's still being studied. Is it that they catch it less? Or is it that they, catch it in comparable amounts to older adults, and they just are less likely to seem visibly ill? And when they're not visibly ill, how much are they still transmitting it? So we know that they still shed virus and can transmit it, even if they're not having symptoms, if they are actually infected. So this matters in terms of the question of, if we reopen schools. And I think this summer we're going through a kind of test run, which is in many places, camps are going to reopen. Here in San Francisco, we are going to do in-person camps. They have to be smaller. I think groups of no more than 12. The kids have to come for a 3-week session and stay together so that you don't have like a new group of children interacting with each other every week. So I think a lot of communities and states plan to learn from the camp experience, and that is probably going to inform the question of, what to do about schools. And then also for coronavirus, as I'm sure you've heard, there's a, we've realized that there's a post-coronavirus inflammatory syndrome that can make some children extremely sick. They seem to get it a few weeks after having coronavirus itself. Often they didn't even realize they had coronavirus, but when we check the antibodies, they have antibodies. So, you know, that is what's happening with children. From the perspective of older adults, you know, I think the more the important issue is, you know, the risk of spending time with children, right? Children who are part of our families or extended families. And then also, if we reopen schools, what will that mean for increasing coronavirus risk or prevalence in our neighborhoods and communities? And that, you know, again, is another area of active debate among experts and requires more research. So, given all that, what can we now say about coronavirus and older adults? So, as everyone I think at this point has heard, being older is associated with a higher risk of severe illness, a higher risk of dying from coronavirus, although most older adults do not die from it. And also, you know, there's some research suggesting that it's associated with a higher susceptibility to catching it when you have a given exposure event. So yeah, this is, you know, this is a real risk for people as they get older. Now, what we have learned, and I think everyone's aware of the very tragic situations we've experienced in nursing homes that have experienced outbreaks. And so, you know, a disproportionate number of the national coronavirus deaths are associated with nursing homes and long-term care. On the flip side, when coronavirus sweeps through a nursing home, they sort of see it manifest in a group of frail older adults. And what they have found is that many of those frail older adults, even people who are age 90 plus, have mild to moderate clinical courses that don't require hospitalization. But, you know, a significant number of them become seriously or critically ill and do die. So this is a really serious situation. For nursing homes, and of course, incredibly scary for older adults who do live in residential facilities and for their families. I have looked it up. It's hard to get an exact fix on the mortality rates. And, you know, the news articles tend to report what proportion of a state's deaths are attributed to nursing homes. And that's important and interesting. But, you know, what I'm often wondering is, well, of the number of people who tested positive in the nursing home, you know, how many died and how many lived? So now nursing homes are mandated to report coronavirus by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and also many states are mandating reporting. So I'll post the link, but AARP has a good website that will show you for every state where you can find the website with information on nursing homes and coronavirus for your state. So I looked today for California, and let me see again if I can find it. But I think it was, there we go. So the report for California this week was a little over 10,000 confirmed cases in nursing homes and 2,000 deaths. So that, you know, works out to a mortality rate of about 20% for us. I think it's often in nursing homes that experience an epidemic higher, maybe, you know, 25 to 30%. So this is terrible by modern standards. And at the same time, it's important to realize that, you know, most people do survive it. So because coronavirus has such high stakes for older adults, then, you know, the exposure risk reduction, right? Like reducing the risk of being exposed to coronavirus is especially being emphasized for older adults. So, you know, we are right now in a national kind of mood of reopening things. There's a lot of you know, pressure to do that. People want to get out and about again. A lot of people need, you know, need the work, right? And the economic activity. And older adults are often still being urged to, like, you know, well, people can start doing things, but be very careful if you're older. Which I think, you know, can, you know, the problem is that that's still imposing these social and physical restrictions for older adults. And so, likewise, most residential facilities are still being extremely cautious and conservative about visitors and activities, and that does keep their older residents safer. But the downside is that it's been really sad and difficult for those residents. For many of them, their family played a really critically important role in providing social activity, sometimes additional like health and care, right? And they have been cut off from that. And then also the group activities and just, group social events, even just eating together, has often been restricted. So this is helping keep older adults safer, but there are real downsides. Isolation is a real problem. As a geriatrician, and I've been talking to, fellow geriatricians, I mean, everybody is reporting that in, nursing homes, they're seeing a lot of older adults seeming depressed, getting worse cognitively, losing physical abilities, and declining. So, I mean, for more on nursing homes and COVID, I just earlier this month or last month, I'm getting a little confused about my dates, but just within the last few weeks, I recorded an interview with my colleague, Dr. Carl Steinberg, who's a longtime nursing home medical director. He's also president-elect of the Society for Long-Term Care Medicine and Post-Acute Care, so lots of expertise on this. So we talked more about, how this could be navigated, but this is what helps keep older adults safer, and I think it's important to lose sight of the fact that there are really significant burdens and costs with this, and it's important for us to keep actively thinking about how to balance them and how to try to mitigate them for older adults. So, given all that, what now and what is next? So, it seems fairly clear that we're going to need to live with this COVID risk and how to navigate it and the related illnesses for at least the next 12 months. Many experts think it's going to be even longer. Because until we have safe and effective vaccines or treatments available, even with coronavirus spreading right now, it would still take quite a long time for us to get to quote unquote herd immunity. We don't even know how long people will stay immune once they've had coronavirus. For instance, people don't maintain long-term immunity to cold viruses. And I think with the related viruses, SARS and MERS, it seems to be only a few years. So, herd immunity is not going to save us anytime soon. We really need a safe and effective vaccine, and that takes, first of all, some time to develop. I mean, already they're hustling. Usually a fast vaccine development is like 3 to 4 years. I think the fastest one before was maybe 4 years. And here they're trying to do it, even faster, and then you have to scale it up so you can give it to, billions of people worldwide. So we really have to think about, this being a marathon. And to remain in maximum isolation and restriction is not viable long term. For people. So it's, really important to be thinking, and there's no easy answer. There's no obvious answer. It has to be a kind of constant dialogue that we have with ourselves, with our families, and within our communities about how we balance the risk reduction, right? Keeping people as safe as possible from COVID, generally with physical distancing measures and restrictions, but also, ideally with, again, those testing, strategies and isolation. How we balance that with economic and social needs, right? People need to make a living, people need to be out doing things, people need to be, people have social and physical needs that need to be met, and often doing what's safest for coronavirus really interferes with that. So of course, there are definitely challenges specific to older adults. Some of the things that I've been thinking about, many older adults are retired, but many of them, are still in the workforce, right? So how will workplaces, schools, for instance, accommodate or protect older employees? That is still getting worked out. I think everybody these past few months has experienced some distress by, being kept apart from people that they wanted to see in person, But it's been especially hard on older adults who often are, can be more dependent on that contact with family and others, especially if they have left the workforce and don't have, jobs or other activities to bring them out so much. Or many of those older adults, had developed systems of socializing with, other groups or activities that have been cut back. Sustained reductions in social and physical activity aren't good for anybody's health. But I think, when people are older or frailer or more vulnerable, then they're especially susceptible to the effects of that. And then, we have the fact that older adults who live in facilities are at particular risk. First of all, it's easier for coronavirus to sweep through there. And then people who live in facilities tend to already be older or frailer or have health conditions. Lastly, a certain number of families are at that stage where they're helping an older adult who's had some declines in abilities and needs additional care. So this has always been a huge challenge for older adults and their families to, adapt to these changes. It's never easy to figure out, are you going to modify the home? Are you going to bring somebody into the home? Should the older person move? And now it's gotten even more complicated to figure that out, because now there are additional risks if you bring somebody in the home, and residential placements are more complicated to consider. So it's all gotten just much, much harder for everybody. So again, no easy answers, but I think it's important to just, be thinking about the ones of these that apply to us. I certainly hope our policymakers, and leaders are thinking about the ones that, have policy implications, right? About like workplaces, and also, overseeing facilities and, the whole sort of social safety network for older adults, which honestly was inadequate before this happened. So hopefully we can shore it up. Of course, states have such a deficit right now because of the loss of economic activity that here in California, they're actually, proposing cuts to services that are really important for older adults. So this is, this is hard. And I would say, to the extent you can, follow at least some of them and try to be involved in, negotiating solutions and in advocating for the needs of older adults and their families, that's helpful. So, but for individuals and families, I do think, what we're seeing is that there is this trade-off now, right? Which is you can be safer from coronavirus, and often that's going to be a trade-off versus more contact and activity with the world, whether that's your family, whether that's with like some activity outside the home that's meaningful to you, either working or volunteering or, socializing with non-family members. So how do we manage that trade-off? And I think of it a little bit differently for individual older adults who are what we would call community dwelling. They live, they don't live in assisted living or nursing homes, let's put it that way, and they're not in the hospital. That's what counts as community living, versus people who do live in residences. So, for individual older adults, taking the maximum action to reduce COVID risk is likely to decrease quality of life and potentially risk future health. I think that it's really important if you are a family member. So what we have always seen in geriatrics is that families, adult children, especially, tend to be more worried about the older person's health and safety than the older person is. So we're seeing that play out with coronavirus. A lot of people are so worried about their older parent or older loved one, and that comes from a place of love and concern, and they want that, older loved one to do everything possible to reduce coronavirus risk. And I get it, and it's important. And we just need to be mindful that we are asking them to endure a decrease often in quality of life and potentially risk their future health. So unless your older loved one has lost memory and thinking abilities and is no longer in their right mind and able to sort of make decisions for themselves, I think our role should be to help older adults be informed and respect their choices as they navigate this trade-off and figure out what risks and burdens are acceptable to them. And then we can also help by, again, encouraging societal activities that help keep the societal environment safer. This is why I would like to see, people wearing masks. Because it's, an older adult's safety is not just about like the personal choices they make. It's also going to be related to the choices we're making as the group around them. But when it comes to their personal choice, I think it's reasonable that some older adults are going to be willing to accept some degree of increased risk for coronavirus if this provides a clear social health or even economic benefit to them. And I think we need to be ready for that. And we need to, I'm sure like weighing that trade-off is hard for them. It's hard for us because maybe they'll be willing to take more risk than we wish they would, but we really have to accept that. And then I think we also, this is a time for creativity. Yes, people might have to accept some risk, but also, can we keep encouraging and facilitating remote forms of social contact? And can we help older adults, navigate this new world and find other ways to feel like some purpose and belonging and activity? So if they can't go and do the things they could do, what are other things? Like can we help make it easier for older adults to volunteer and otherwise contribute their skills to their community in ways that put them at less physical risk? I think, there's really something to be said for being creative about this and encouraging older adults to apply their creativity and innovations. Because if the message we send to older adults is you're fragile and we need to protect you and that's it over and over again, that's not great for people's psyche. So some people are quite frail and vulnerable and need protection, but still, I think we need to find a middle ground there. And then it's definitely trickier for older adults who reside in nursing homes and facilities because there, your choices aren't just about putting yourself at risk. They affect the safety and risks of the people, there, your household is, to a certain extent, people in the facilities. So people who live in nursing homes and facilities are going to have less personal choice. Visits and activities are going to be determined by the facility, which is going to be largely influenced by the guidance or requirements. There's a difference that they are getting from the federal level, the state level, and the county. So again, I think creativity and innovation is needed here, so we can find ways to try to reduce that risk of coronavirus transmission while still meeting social and physical needs of residents. I mean, right now, there's a lot of FaceTiming with family. If it's possible to get the older person a device and make sure they're able to use it. But how can we go beyond that? Or maybe for some people, it's just making sure that they're even getting that. And I think also that facilities are going to respond to what is the vibe of families and residents, right? And is it like maximum safety, or is it how can we balance safety and these quality of life issues? So I think it is useful for families and residents to think about what are their top goals and preferences, and what trade-offs would they be willing to consider? Because I don't know that nursing homes right now are going to be ready to relax the visitor policy. But do we want to be no visitors for another year? These are conversations that we need to have. So to kind of wrap this up, I came across this week an article I really liked in the New York Times, 5 Rules to Live By During a Pandemic. I thought it was a great summary, so I wanted to share them, and I will post a link. These were 5 rules to, again, help you, not particularly geared towards older adults, but still, balance safety versus activity. So these are all great ideas. One, check the health of your state and community. So again, being aware of how much coronavirus is going around in my area. Is it on the upswing or the downswing? They also recommended following the percentage of positive COVID tests in your state, in your local metro area would be better. That ideally it should be less than 5% or lower for the past 2 weeks. I think they said 2% is even better. So that's kind of a measure of how much coronavirus is out there and how dangerous it is when you interact with the world. So I thought that was a great idea. They suggest limiting the number of your close contacts. So again, a smaller household. Some people are, considering a bubble or a pod connecting with another household. So again, the smaller the number of people in that group, the better. They talk about managing your exposure budget, right? That we could think about, exposing ourselves to coronavirus a little bit the way a dieter might think about, a budget for, sugar or whatever it is, the thing that you're trying to minimize. Are you going to sort of like blow a lot of it on one thing, or are you going to be careful and, regularly take on a little bit of risk? And again, this requires having an idea. Again, for every activity, is this an activity where I'm taking on a lot of risk or just a small amount of risk, right? Or how could I make it less risky? They recommend keeping higher risk activities as short as possible. So I think that's also a great idea because, as I was explaining, the more time you spend in a risky situation, the larger viral load or, greater the chance that you'll get enough of an exposure to really tip you into illness. And then their last recommendation was to keep taking pandemic precautions. And by that, they meant, the physical distancing, the masks. I mean, in a lot of parts of the country, we're seeing people, really be pretty relaxed about this. I mean, I think especially if you're in a part of the country where there hasn't been a lot of coronavirus, that's understandable. But it's safer if we can keep the distance, if possible. And certainly, if there has been coronavirus in your area or it's on the upswing, then it's even more important. So, to wrap up with my suggestions for this summer. I think in general it's fairly safe to be outside. I've heard some older adults say they're afraid to walk outside if anyone else is walking outside. I think that's really fairly low risk. One can never say never, but it's probably fairly low risk, and outside is going to be the safer way to see other people if you want to see family. And it's going to be even safer outside if people wear masks and they don't get, too close to you. So ideally not within, 6 feet. If you want to hug a grandchild, there was also a widely shared New York Times article showing, a few techniques that would again, again keeping the hug shorter, and again, some hug techniques that minimize the face-to-face contact or the older person having the chance to breathe in the germs of another person. Also, I think we generally all should be wearing masks when outside our household. If we're any, certainly if you're in another indoor space, or if you're outside and getting, within 6 feet of other people. This helps you protect others, and it's especially important for the safety of older adults. So I really think this is about doing, a service to other people. And also, the more people we see wearing masks, the more we normalize it, right? And it tends to then cycle up and increase mask wearing. And it reminds people to take this seriously. And I think the challenge for us is to take this seriously without letting it grind us down. Or depress us. But by taking it seriously, we can make our communities safer for everybody, especially those members of our community who are at higher risk, which are, often our older family members or other older people. And then, otherwise, be careful about not touching your face when you're out. Be careful about flying or other activities that put you in close indoor proximity to others. Some people might want to consider a pod or bubble with another person or household. If you're considering that, choose carefully. Find out like how much exposure they are experiencing based on their choices and their life circumstances. And smaller pods are better. And then I won't go into depth about this. I've talked about it before, but I think advanced planning remains really important. If you haven't already picked a healthcare proxy, this is a good time to do it. Even if you have a health proxy, this is a good time to talk to them, right? And make sure that, they've heard you think through what your goals and priorities would be if you got very sick, especially if you got sick enough to be hospitalized from COVID. So, and when we do advanced planning, ideally we have, some reasonable expectations about, how things are likely to play out if we were very sick, right? So it's important to know that people who are already quite frail or declining in health are at high risk for dying, and they're unlikely to do well if they're sick enough to be hospitalized or put on the ventilator. And again, if they survive the ventilator, there's a long, long, long recovery. So some people, knowing this, will still say that they want to have life support if it becomes necessary, and that's completely fine. It's just important to be aware of your odds, and also aware that it's also okay to say, I want to be taken care of, and if I'm getting, if it's looking like I'm getting very sick and would need a ventilator, I would rather then be transitioned to being kept comfortable. That's okay too. Ideally we just make a we have a thoughtful, informed conversation about it, and we let the people who are going to make decisions for us know. So the conversationproject.org has a really good little talking guide for having a conversation about this in the context of coronavirus. But then they don't do actual advanced directives. For advanced directives, I really like the ones at prepareforyourcare.org. They have easy non-legalese advanced directives for almost all 50 states. I think it's for 48 or 49 states. I do also recommend Pulsed Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Care. It's called MOLST, or MOST in some states, medical orders for life-sustaining care, or medical orders for scope of treatment, I think, for people who are seriously ill or chronically incapacitated, including people with dementia. So again, that takes the information that's in the advanced directive and turns it into some more kind of practical guidance or choices in the event of an emergency. And then, especially if you're not inclined to go with the default in American healthcare, which is do everything, then I encourage you, or if you're making this decision on behalf of a family member, to talk with health providers about what would be the options, right? So if for some reason you, as a family, decide that it would be really disruptive if you have a mom who's a lot older and maybe has dementia, and you thought about it and realized it would be really disruptive to put her in the hospital where she couldn't have visitors, where she'd be even more confused, and not likely to survive if she got sick enough for the ventilator. You want to know what would be the options for treating her coronavirus if she didn't go, right? And your health provider should be able to talk to you about that, and I would encourage that. So, to wrap up, we should plan to live with COVID risk for at least the next 12 months. Age and chronic health conditions increase risk, but really everyone is at some risk, right? So let's just think about that. We're all at some risk. It's just some of us are at more risk than others. So we all need to think about balancing risk reduction, so physical distancing and restrictions, with economic and social needs. Frail and vulnerable older adults are both at the highest risk from catching COVID, but also often at the highest risk from suffering from strict safety measures, such as reduced social activities and physical activities. So this is a really challenging trade-off. There's no easy answer. We just need to think it through, and do the best we can in acknowledging the trade-off and thinking about people's values and preferences. For this summer, I think the New York Times five rules are good. Learning to keep an eye on the COVID health of your state and community, limiting close contacts, managing the exposure budget, keeping higher risk activities as short as possible, and keep taking those precautions, especially masks, hand washing, and some physical distancing. So yes, this is going to be a difficult time, especially for our older adults, but for all of us. I truly think that supporting societal measures that reduce COVID risk in the community is an important way to support our older adults, that we all need to be creative about how we can help people maintain social and physical engagement while keeping COVID risk low. And then last but not least, take care of yourselves. This is a difficult time. We shouldn't underestimate it. If you're sad or anxious or mourning, that is normal. That is to be expected. So take care of yourself. Reach out and find support where you can. I think we can sustain ourselves partly in taking care of ourselves, but also thinking about how we can take care of our neighbors and community, because this is a time for us to come together. And so then after we've given ourselves our moment to acknowledge our grief, our confusion, our worry about a future we can't control, then we can also focus on what we can do and what we can enjoy, and how hopefully we can enjoy the summer and make the best of it despite the restrictions and limitations. So that's what I have for today. I hope this was helpful. Thank you so much for being part of our readership community or listening community at Better Health While Aging. If you have questions, please post them below in the comments section, and we will see what we can do. I'm now assisted in answering questions by my wonderful geriatrician colleague, Dr. Nicole Didick, and otherwise we'll perhaps post another update later this summer. Take care, everybody. And with that, I'm going to wrap up this episode of Better Health While Aging. If you have any questions about something you heard in this episode, you can post it on the show notes page for the episode. I'll also be posting some links to some of the resources that I mentioned in the episode. To find the show notes, visit betterhealthwhileaging.net and click podcast in the main menu at the top. Last but not least, if you've been enjoying the podcast, don't forget to support us by subscribing on iTunes, and if you've already done that, please leave a rating and review. This makes it easier for others to discover our show in iTunes, and I would love for the many people who are interested in health or aging or family caregivers to be able to find it and give it a chance. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Dr. Leslie Kernison, and I'm looking forward to you joining us for future episodes.